before beginning today's reading, I think I made a mistake yesterday when I was talking about the monk that was subject to that criticism in Wat Pa Pong in many years ago in times past. And when I was talking about the senior Ajahns there, Ajahn Liam, Ajahn Chu, it was, and I said Ajahn Kampong, it should be Ajahn Kampoon. Ajahn Kampong is not the same person as Ajahn Kampoon. And I think I said Kampong, so just by way of correction, because these things are being recorded, so that there's a caveat, or someone can go in and edit and change the Kampong to a Kampoon. Lumpur Kampoon was the one who passed away quite recently. Lumpur Kampong is still alive and active. So this next section is called A Well-Rounded Training with the... the next section is called Patipada, as part of it's a subsection of the part on well-rounded training. So Patipada, which is the Pali word meaning practice or the practice of Dhamma. Monks often take on special observances in order to get out of a rut or in the hope of accelerating their practice. At the very least, by doing so, they exercise powers of diligence, vigor, and renunciation, all of which are important qualities for monks to cultivate. However, Lumpur would remind those of his disciples prone to putting their faith in radical but unsustainable asceticism to look closely at the intention behind their undertakings. A short period of heroic effort, followed by a longer lazy period of recuperation, was not, he insisted, a wise or effective strategy for dealing with defilement. Craving for results too easily infected a mind set up in this way. For him, the key to success was patipada, steady, consistent, continuous practice. And the footnote on this says, this is the definition adopted by the Thai forest tradition. In fact, this Pali word simply means way of practice and may be beneficial or unbeneficial depending on context. Here it may be understood as an abbreviation of Samma Patipada, or right practice. So for him, the key to success was Patipada, steady, consistent, continuous practice, the tortoise rather than the hare. And this is Lumpur Cha speaking. Don't pay any attention to whether you're feeling diligent or lazy. Normally, people do things when they feel diligent and stop when they feel lazy. But as monks, that's not how we conduct ourselves. Whether we feel lazy or diligent, we practice. We have no interest other than cutting things off, in abandoning them, in training ourselves. We're consistent day and night, this year and next, at all hours, indifferent to feelings of laziness or diligence, hot or cold. We just keep doing it. This is called patipada. Sometimes monks get really gung-ho and sustain it for 6 or 7 days, but when they see they're not getting anywhere, then they give up. And then they really lose it for a while, chatting and socializing in a heedless way, until they come to their senses and put in another couple of days of hard effort. Then they give up again until the next time they feel inspired, and that becomes the pattern. It's like people who throw themselves into their work like there's no tomorrow, digging fields, clearing trees, clearing hillsides, and then, when it's time to take a break, throw their tools down and walk off without putting them away. By the following morning, the tools are completely caked with mud. Then they get enthusiastic for the work again, and in the evening throw their tools down once more. This is not the way to prepare fields for cultivation, and it's the same for our practice. If you don't think patipada is important, you'll have no success. Patipada is absolutely vital. Making fire was another of Lumpur's favorite analogies for this principle, one that allowed him to perform a favorite short pantomime. As he spoke, and with a big smile on his face, he would mime the fool who rubs two sticks together until he becomes tired or bored, puts them down for a while before picking them up once more, expecting to carry on from where he'd left off. Finally, he gives up altogether and compounds his error by insisting that he knows from experience that it's not possible to get fire from wood. There is fire there, Lumpur said, but you're only going to produce it if you keep rubbing the sticks without interruption until the critical temperature has been reached. In the same way, practice can only bear fruit when it's developed in a similar, steady manner. Short bursts of effort, no matter how intense, cannot create the necessary momentum. That's also an analogy that the Buddha used in the suttas, that making fire by rubbing two sticks together, and then that sense of getting tired and stopping and then starting again and wondering why you can't get the fire from the wood, and that blaming the sticks, or saying that it's impossible to get fire from rubbing two sticks together, because you just proved that it's impossible because of the way you've done it, but it's because of that lack of consistency that is the reason that the fire and the friction, necessary friction and heat, hasn't been produced. So again, this is Lumpur speaking. A fisherman casts his net and catches a huge fish. He becomes afraid that the fish is going to jump out of the net and get away. He becomes so anxious, he grabs at the fish wildly, struggles to get a grip on it. Suddenly, just as he feared, the fish is out of the net, but it escapes because his own efforts to grasp hold of it are too violent. There's an old saying, gently, gently does it, but not too gently. That's our practice. Keep feeling things out, feeling them out. Don't give up. You have to look at the mind, understand what it's all about. Try to keep doing the practice, making it consistent. If you're feeling lazy, do the practice. If you're not feeling lazy, do the practice. That's the kind of continuity that's needed. He often repeated that the craving to get something or become something would always sabotage even the most determined effort. Again, this is Lumpur speaking. The Buddha taught that putting forth effort is for abandonment, for letting go, for withdrawing from attachment. There should be no desire for becoming and birth, to get or to be anything at all. This effort was to be constantly monitored and tweaked, the goal being a balanced level called podi, or just right. Putting forth effort that, moment by moment, was maintained at the optimum intensity for achieving one's purpose. Lumpur defined as right practice. Sorry, I'll read that sentence again. Putting forth effort that, moment by moment, was maintained at the optimum intensity for achieving one's purpose, Lumpur defined as right practice. And then, again, Lumpur is speaking here. Putting forth effort is not restricted to a particular posture. You can do it while standing, walking, sitting, and lying down. You can realize Dhamma while sweeping leaves, or merely by looking at a sunbeam. It is essential that mindfulness be constantly primed. Why? Because when you're intent on discernment of the truth, there are opportunities to realize the Dhamma at all times and in all places. So that comment that Ajahn Jayasaro makes here, and that is spelled out in Lumpur's teachings, craving to get something or become something would always sabotage even the most determined effort. So that became a very central feature of Lumpur Sumato's teachings, and those of you who've read his books or listened to his talks over the years will have heard him say over and over again to have the attitude of practicing now in order to become enlightened in the future, or I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to become enlightened in the future. He said that is, you're starting from wrong view, that's a wrong understanding. And that very forming of the idea, I am an unenlightened person and who has to do something now to become enlightened in the future, even though that might sound like, well, isn't that what it says in the teachings? Yeah, doesn't that? Isn't that the model that we all work with? That Lumpur Sumato would point to over and over again and say as a radical mistake, because in that way the practice is being based on self-view. I am a person, which is I would say is a wrong view. I am a person who is unenlightened, and I have to do something now to become enlightened in the future. So in that framework, even though it might make sense in terms of conventional truth or a worldly way of expressing things, it's creating the idea of I am a person, that this body, this personality, this individual is a separate, independent entity, and that so it's cementing, it's concretizing, making solid the idea of personality or identity. Also, it's solidifying the quality of time, that that over this time then things will change and I will become that enlightened person in the future. So it's casting the whole thing into the framework of personality and time, identity and time. And so that Lumpur Sumedha would point over and over again to change the view, rather than holding on to the idea, I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now to become enlightened in the future, to, as he would put it, be awake now, and to let go of the habit of thinking I am a person or I'm an unenlightened person, because that which knows the person is not a person. That quality of awareness that knows all the personal qualities of a body, a personality, of location, of time, of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, that which is knowing the personal is not a person. That quality of awareness is not female, it's not male, it's not old, it's not young, it has no form, has no age. Those personal qualities, located and time-bound, individual qualities, don't apply. So those personal attributes are known by that aware mind, but they are not that. That's why all these reflections are, on anatta, the body is not self, rupang anatta, vedana anatta, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. So those reflections on the five khandhas and anatta are trying to underscore that basic realization, and what is the gateway to liberation, that that which knows the person isn't a person. That which knows time and identity and location is not bound by time, identity, or location. That awareness is liberated from the five khandhas, and so that the process of insight meditation and these kind of reflections are underscoring that. So it makes a very different framework. So rather than starting with the premise, the idea that I am an unenlightened person, Lumpur Sumedha would stress over and over again, over the last 30 years or so, he's pretty much only said that. Almost every Dhamma talk he's given, those of you who've been around when he was teaching a year ago here for a couple of weeks in December, and then the open retreat when he was teaching here, well, pretty much every single Dhamma talk he's giving is, be awake now, and to not create the idea of I'm an unenlightened person who needs to do something now to become enlightened in the future. So to recognize that as a sort of conventional way of speaking, or a convenient fiction, but to rather base the practice on a direct knowing here in the present. So ironically or appropriately, the next section is called Knowing Now. That was not a happy coincidence. I didn't actually see that until I just read it this second. Lumpur often said that the present moment encompasses everything. It includes past and future because it is the result of the former and the cause of the latter. So the present moment, what we experience now, is the effect or the result of everything that's happened before. Everything that's happened up to this moment in the universe contributes to this experience in this moment. So the present moment is the result of everything that's gone before, and also what is done in the present moment and how things are in the present moment is the cause for what will be experienced in the future. It contributes to that cause. So the present moment encompasses everything. It includes past and future because it is the result of the former and the cause of the latter. For this reason, developing the ability to dwell with clarity in the present moment is perhaps the most fundamental of all meditation skills. However, Lumpur said the value of it did not just lie in the lucid calm that resulted from letting go of memory and imagination. It was in the present moment that wisdom could be cultivated. Lumpur is speaking. In Dhamma practice, All you have to do is keep looking at the present moment. Look at the instability, the impermanence, and Buddha knowing will arise and grow. That's Puru is the expression in Thai language. Literally meaning the one who knows. Also, Ajahn Jayasaro would use the expression more commonly nowadays of Tat Ru, meaning the element or the from the Pali word Dhatu, in Thai is Tat. So the element of knowing, Tat Ru. Look at the instability, the impermanence, and Buddha knowing will arise and grow. Keep seeing the truth of all things, that they are impermanent. Pleasure and pain arise, and they're impermanent. It's unsure how long they'll last. If our mind sees the uncertain duration of things, the problem of attachment will gradually diminish. The past was gone, the future had not yet arrived. Suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path towards its end all lie in the present moment. And again, Lumpur is speaking. The practice of staying in the present is mental cultivation. To put it simply, we must be mindful, have a constant awareness and recollection, knowing what is occurring right now, what we're thinking, what we're doing, what's going on with us. We must look at our mind, constantly mindful of our mood, our thoughts, whether we're experiencing pleasant or unpleasant feelings, whether we are in the right or in the wrong. Reflecting, investigating in this way, the wisdom faculty has already manifested. The eyes see a form, the ears hear a sound, the nose smells an odor, the tongue experiences a flavor, the body a touch. Whatever is felt is known. Whether we think something is good or bad, we like it or we dislike it, it's all impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. The Buddha taught us to put these things down, not to grasp onto them. This is called solving problems. So any questions, thoughts, reflections on that? The next section is called Mainair, which is the...
In those moments of stillness when the thinking subsides, my question is whether to sort of drop in a question or a wondering, or whether to just stay with that stillness. My experience is that dropping in those questions sometimes does bring a deep knowing of an answer. But then I'm wondering, am I actually just trying to run away from staying with stillness, which is a little bit boring?
Well, it's a good question. I think, as with every aspect of the practice, it's looking at the results of it. Yeah, and also to experiment. So if you have an experience of that quality of openness, stillness being there, and then you say, okay, now on this occasion, let's just leave that unoccupied and see what happens. Yeah, just to explore, to investigate that. Just leave it without any kind of object in it, see what the quality of that is, and then, or as you describe, or when you put something in, you drop something into that and see what arises from that. So looking at the results of what we do, and the seeing the cause and the effect, and being guided by that. When we were here in the 80s and Lumpur Sumedho was teaching a lot about dependent origination, he was very actively encouraging people not to just enjoy that sort of spacious, open quality and sort of internal sunbathing, the sort of having a bright, peaceful, quiet mind. And so he was actively encouraging very vigorously the use of that internal brightness and clarity to take, in that instance, particular pieces of the dependent origination, the 12 links of dependent origination, and then he would sometimes just talk about a single word for a few days, or often he'd take a section of the cycle, like salayatana pasavedana, the six senses, contact, feeling, or tanha upadana bhava, craving, clinging, becoming. And or he spent weeks and weeks just on avijja paccaya sankhara, ignorance, conditions, formations. So he would give a lot of talks around that and encourage the active use of that inner space and clarity to drop in those themes of Dhamma and to explore what the meaning is or how those particular qualities related with each other, and to help us to, in a sense, get to know the fabric of how the mind experiences and how that whole process of dependent origination works and how it can be prevented from getting underway and so forth. But I say over and over again, everyone is different, and so that it's important. I would encourage people to explore and to experiment and to see for yourself, because it might be that just there, as you were just saying, maybe that you're afraid of that spaciousness, and so you want to have something in there so there's an object to play with, or something to give a sense of being, or a sense of something to be done, or some interesting object to relate to. And so if there's an intuition of, hey, am I just sort of afraid of this space and quietness? Is that just getting away from this? To explore that, just to test it out and to see, okay, if this is deliberately left open as much as possible, what's the effect of that? What occurs, what arises with respect to that? So then you're learning how your own mind works, your own personality, your own sort of conditioning, and so that it's not just taken on a sort of recommendation from a teaching, but rather you're teaching yourself. You're learning how your own system works. So the next section is called Mainair, which is the Thai words. Mai is a negative, like not, no. Nair is certainty. So Mainair is the Thai words for the quality of uncertainty. This is a major theme of Lumpur Cha's teaching. Mainair. In the last 5 or 6 years of his teaching career, most of Lumpur's Dhamma talks were recorded on audio cassette. In this collection of talks, now stored digitally, Lumpur deals with a wide variety of themes, amongst which one frequently repeated teaching stands out, that of Mainair. The phrase Mainair translates most readily as unsure, uncertain, changeful, or indefinite. The Pali word closest to the idea of Mainair is viparinama, usually rendered in English as subject to change. And it's so Mainair is an everyday term that all of Lumpur's audience will have immediately understood. A farmer, for example, asked in the planting season whether he expected to get a good harvest that year, would most probably reply, Mainair. If we get enough rain, it should be all right. The phrase Mainair here is a simple recognition that things are affected by many variable conditions, for example, how much rain falls, and are thus never completely predictable. Lumpur taught his disciples to practice the perception of Mainair as a means of cultivating the wisdom faculty, by constantly reminding themselves that both internal and external phenomena were Mainair. They developed anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence, and with practice, the associated perception of dukkha, the inherently flawed, ultimately unsatisfactory nature of experience, and anatta, the conditioned, selfless nature of experience. These perceptions of the three characteristics of existence created a pathway for vipassana, the deep, wordless insight that uproots defilements and leads to the end of suffering. The practice of Mainair achieves its power from directly confronting the ingrained tendency of unawakened beings to invest experience with the appearance of solidity. This sense that things within and without are as real and substantial, this sense that things within us and without us are real and substantial is founded upon unexamined assumptions. The perception of changefulness became the tool Lumpo most often recommended to challenge those assumptions. Lumpo chose to use the phrase Mainair in preference to the more traditional Anichang, or impermanent, to bring a fresh slant on wisdom development. For his disciples, Mainair was a familiar, approachable idea, deeply embedded in the culture. It demystified Dhamma practice and made it seem immediately practical. Another point that I like to bring up with respect to that, and why Lumpo Cha used Mainair, or uncertainty, as a translation for Anicca, because technically Anicca means more that Nietzsche is permanence or stability. Anicca is not permanent, unstable. And so it's talking about qualities of an object, like that thing. You know, this glass is Anicca, the water is Anicca, the table is Anicca, this book is Anicca, these words are Anicca. They are things which are in a state of change. The ideas are Anicca. An idea is a thing that's changing. A word is a thing that's changing. So that aspect of Anicca, which is talking about the changing nature of objects, can place it somewhat in the objective world. It's out there. That thing there is changing, even if it's a thought in the mind or a memory. That it's a thing that is somewhat remote. It's an object that is changing. So the mind can look at it with a kind of technical or sort of a mechanistic attitude. It's that thing is in a state of change, almost like a sort of a physical characteristic, a quality of that thing. The quality of Mainair, uncertainty, is talking about the subject on the felt side, the feeling side. Of when the heart meets with a thing in a state of change, it doesn't know what it's going to change into. It doesn't know what's going to happen next. So the feeling on the subject side is uncertainty. And so that it's that's the felt sense when the heart, the mind receives or is aware of that changeful, unstable quality, then the subjective feeling, that what's felt in the heart is, ooh, I don't know what's going to happen next. Is it going to get better? Is it going to get worse? Don't know what's going to happen. There's that emotional tone to it. So rather than being like a technical description of changingness, a thing out there, then it's more the subjective feeling, what the emotional tone of that changefulness, what that brings to the heart. So as Ajahn Jayasaro describes it here, it was a familiar, approachable idea. So yeah, it's closer to home, as it were. It's like a something that's got a greater color, a greater strength, a greater impact. And so that was more often than not the way that Lumpur talked about that development of the Anicca Sanya, the perception of impermanence, and a way of really making it alive, rather than just sort of, it's impermanent, 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 like a sort of technical description of the state of something, but rather that how the attitude was relating to it. And as he said, that the point of that reflection is to confront the ingrained tendencies of unawakened beings to invest experience with the appearance of solidity. So because we tend to try and make things certain, we assume things are predictable, we know what's going to happen this evening or tomorrow, or we assume things to hold together, that you know, things are going to continue as they have been, or we know what they're going to change into. That, say, the reflection on Anicca, on uncertainty, this Mainair, is challenging that, so, basically the ego-centered dependency on predictability. And we like to be sure, we ensure things because we want to be sure. That's what insurance is, so that we will be sure about things that are not sure. Hence, insurance companies. I mean, that's right there. I mean, that's what the word means. You're not sure, so you want to be insured. You want to be covered. You want to be sure. So you've got insurance is what makes you get away from that uncertain feeling. But no matter how hard you try to protect yourself or insure yourself, then things continue to be relentlessly unsure. And so that But that confrontation is not to increase the quality of sort of neurotic anxiety, but rather it's revealing how there's a foolish dependency on things being reliable or predictable, and that when the heart recognizes that quality of instability and changefulness, then there's a quality of freedom. As Lumpu Cha would put it, if you stop looking for certainty in that which is uncertain, then you're able to free yourself from suffering. If you're looking for certainty in that which is intrinsically uncertain, you're bound to suffer. If you're looking for predictability in that which is unpredictable, you're bound to suffer because you can't find it there. It's not there. You're looking in the wrong place. It's like if you dropped your keys in the sala and you're looking in the temple, you're looking in the wrong place for your keys. So that you're not going to find, no matter how hard you look, you're not going to find them in the temple because they're in the sala. So he would often use that kind of example of you're looking in the wrong place. If you're looking for certainty in that which is uncertain, you have to suffer. But if you realize, oh, it's uncertain, then you free yourself from that search, that scramble. So it's that reflection on anicca, on uncertainty. It's frustrating and intimidating to the ego, but it's liberating to the heart. It's the citta itself has a sense of course. Well, duh, you know, how could it not be uncertain? It's always been this way. It can't be any other way. You know, that's how it's always been. And so there's a quality of relief and freedom to the heart. And then the experience of the unknown to the citta itself brings a quality of wonderment, and there's a sense of wonder or a kind of delight in the face of the unknown. Whereas when the ego, when the self-view meets the unknown or the uncertain, generally it feels intimidated and threatened and wants to protect itself. The specific emphasis of the Mainaya practice may be examined by comparing it to the comparable phrase, "this too will pass," quote unquote. Whereas "this too will pass" reminds us of a future beyond the present experience and so puts it into perspective, Mainaya points to the nature of the present phenomena itself. In daily life, Lumpur taught that the Mainaya reflection was particularly effective in dealing with attachment to ideas and views. In this context, the word might better be translated as "maybe not," quote unquote. Whenever the mind was about to draw a conclusion or jump to one, when it was about to make a judgment about something, he taught the meditator to recall, "maybe not. Maybe that's not how it is. Maybe that's not how it happened. Maybe that's not what he or she is really like." Whenever the sense of certainty arose, meditators were to temper it with a gentle, "maybe not." Even if they were convinced, they were still to reserve a small space in their mind for the possibility of being wrong. Yes, but just maybe not. In this way, the mind was to become more careful and nuanced in its attitudes. So that, and you can use your own phraseology, use your own languages for this, along with "maybe not." Another version of that I heard Lumpur was using was just to say, "Is that so? That's awful. Is that so? This is great. Is that so? That was a really terrible thing. Is that so? That was wonderful. Is that so? This is beautiful. Is that so? This is awful. That's ugly. Is that so?" And again, just to apply that, you have to be quick on your feet, because the mind makes thousands of judgments per day, liking, disliking, approving, disapproving. And almost all the judgments that the mind makes, it assumes are valid representations of reality. I'm not reading anybody's mind, but most of us function that way. If we say something is delicious, we assume that it is. We say something is ugly, we assume that it is. We don't, unless we're being mindful and attentive, we don't even recognize that we're making judgments. But the mind does, hundreds, thousands of times a day. So if you are alert, quick on your feet, as it were, and then train the mind to notice those judgments being made, and then to use this kind of questioning, that's great, maybe not, or is that so? And another even more simple reflection that I like to encourage, which again I heard Lumpur being quoted as saying, was in English just using the word "so." That's great. So I'm really unhappy about that. So again, it's not very comforting or sort of consoling. It's like, I'm really upset. So I'm really excited. So. So it can seem a bit of a damper or not very say reassuring or comforting in those ways that like a little child likes to be comforted, but it is quite realistic and quite refreshing, and it can put our emotional reactions and judgments and habits into a very good and clear context. So it's extremely simple, just so. that's all you have to bring to mind. But then what is most important with that kind of practice is when you bring that sort of reflection into consciousness, you know, maybe not, or is that so, or so, then to look at the effect of that when you bring that to mind, say, oh, that was a real disaster, you know, I really messed up there, then when you say so, to look, what's the effect of that, to be making that kind of comment, or asking that kind of question from a place of clarity, then to see how that changes the, oh, I'm a terrible person, I'm really so stupid, what will people think of me, I really messed up, that was so awful, so, something in the heart goes, oh right, it's not the end of the world, or that's not the whole story, or, yeah, but you don't have to look at it that way, and all of that is something that the heart intuits or can appreciate to some degree just from that simple reflection. So looking at the result of applying those reflections is extremely important, and then it has its own effect. It's not just a matter of repeating the words, maybe not, maybe not, maybe not, maybe not, like some sort of mantra, but it's actually making the statement internally and then looking at the results of that. And so my own experience of using these kind of reflections and questions is very, very simple, but extraordinarily powerful. It's like a key, you know, a key is a small thing, but it is the right key for the right lock. if you're locked outside of a building, the right key for the right lock kind of opens it up and you can get into the building. So it's a small thing. It's not like, it doesn't take a heroic effort. If you've got the right key, it's not sort of an enormous project. But if it's the right key and the right lock, then click, that's that application of that kind of reflection, like a key opening a door to a building. Is that you? It opens up the space. It's so that the key also needs to be applied. You can have the key and keep it in your pocket and not put it in the lock. Might be the right key, but if you don't put it in the lock and turn it, you won't get through the door. So that it's both seeing the value of establishing those kind of reflections and then applying it, taking the key out, putting the key in the lock, you know, and then witnessing the result of opening the door and seeing how that changes our perspective, changes the view, then that is an extremely helpful and powerful kind of practice and very liberating in my experience. Lumpur gave this practice the greatest importance, and he's speaking here, my Nair is the Buddha himself, he would say, it is the Dhamma. He taught the recollection of my Nair both as a means of re-educating a person's attitude to their life and also as a specific technique in meditation. As hindrances arose in the course of a sitting, he would encourage the meditator to recognize the hindrance as my Nair, or changeful, before returning to the breath. As the mind became more subtle, this accumulated perception of my Nair, that whatever arises does not endure, is an exercise of the wisdom faculty that ensures that the mind does not fall into the trap of attaching to joy or to stillness, and is primed to develop vipassana. And the boy is speaking here. When you see impermanence clearly, you become a true monk. Seeing the impermanence, the instability of form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness, the mind does not attach to the five aggregates. Doesn't matter what it is. Even if something happens that upsets you so much that tears are forming in your eyes, remind yourself, this is my nair. Always bear this in mind with your sati, with your alertness. Whether you feel satisfied, dissatisfied, think this is good, this is bad, see it all as my nair, and you can release the attachment. When you see things as ultimately without value, the letting go occurs automatically. My nair is the object of vipassana. When something arises, call it my nair. Don't forget this word. Don't let it drop. The Buddha taught us not to grasp onto the good or the bad. Whatever arises, pool your resources in this word. It's the source of wisdom and the object of vipassana. Make it your constant focus of attention. It'll take you beyond doubt. My nair is a tool to uproot attachment to experience. It will enable you to see the Dhamma clearly. One of the means by which Lumpur sought to inculcate the principle of my nair in his disciples' minds was by maintaining an element of unpredictability in their daily lives. Changes would be introduced to the monastic schedule without prior warning and with no indication of how long they would last. A monk preparing for the annual rains retreat at Wat Pa Phong might be told a day or two before it began that he would be doing the retreat elsewhere, that he should gather his things together, clean up his kuti, and be ready to leave within the hour for a monastery hundreds of kilometers away. It was the style that kept monks on their toes, and it enabled Lumpur to create a singular atmosphere in his monastery, one in which the calming effects of simplicity and repetition were enlivened by a sense that nothing could be taken for granted. Ajahn Chah remembered how plans could change in a single moment. He'd say to me, "Get your bowl and robes, we're going to such and such a place." By the time I got back with my things, he'd say, "Change your plan." This happened so often that I got a real feeling for my nair. Afterwards, I came to understand it to mean dividing things up 50-50. Maybe, maybe not. I adopted it as my guiding principle in practice. So we are a lot more predictable and plan-oriented. The things get written up on the board, and they tend to go with a greater degree of certainty or predictability. But nature does tend to provide its own supply of minareness, just in the natural course of things. But that's often the way that things were done. Also, another of the kind of going back to the sort of the benevolent dictatorship. If you were supposed to be traveling with the Ajahn, and he said, get your bowl and robes. So we're going away to such and such a place. If he got to the car before you did, he might easily say, okay, let's just go, and leave the other person behind, because, well, he's supposed to be with me, he's not here, okay, just go, leave him behind. So you're left with your bowl and your robes, and then, oh, where's Lumpur, where's the car? Oh, he left already. Oh, okay, I guess I'm not going to such and such a place. Or sometimes what happened was that you had gone to visit somewhere, to a festival, like a Tot Papa, like a robe offering festival, or almsgiving event, or a katina, and again, you're supposed to be in the traveling in the van with the Ajahn, and you haven't got your stuff together, and you may be off at some remote monastery hundreds of kilometers away, and you're supposed to get in to be there to get in the van to go back to Wat Pa Phong, but then Lumpur would say, you know, where's Tan so and so, Pasado, Benai, he went to get his bowl, he's not here yet, okay, bye, and so then Pasado would be left there and Suan Chloe like. And then, Lumpur's already gone. How am I going to get back to Wat Pa Phong? Good question. So either you stay here or you start walking. And so that was something that added a regular flavor of monastic life, that sense of not being sure. And then again, I was mentioning the other day about the length of meditation sittings, that you never knew when Lumpur was going to ring the bell. And it might be sometimes you'd have a puja for half an hour or so, sit down, and then ding, the bell would go after 15 minutes. You go, oh, so we're ready. Sometimes it would be an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours. And if it was going on for a long time, the fatal thing to do was to, if somebody, because it was quite dark in the meditation hall, and there was a clock, a grandfather clock up by the shrine. So if somebody took their torch and shone their torch on the clock face, there was usually a groan would go up around there. Oh, going to be at least another hour here. You know. It's like it was already like 11:15, and some novice going, click. Oh, okay, it's going to be a midnight session, this one. So that the novice would probably be given some helpful feedback by his companions the next day. Any thoughts, questions?
Just thinking, Ajahn, the place of Vipassana is normally associated with Upacharya, never with concentration. Is that because it, by its nature, is uncertain? It's like, it's not quite stable, it's not jhana, is it? It's access concentration. So is that, it seems, the place for Vipassana to be brought in?
Well, it's recognized as being the most fertile ground, because the attention isn't locked onto a single object, but rather, what Lumbosamedo would call the point that includes. So the object is the whole of the present moment, and all the arising of the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. You know, all of the field of experience is coming and going and changing, so that the mind is paying attention to the present. It's not wandering off into or getting lost in its imagination or memory or in moods and perceptions. So it's clearly attentive to the present, but the range of what's arising and what's knowable in the present is extremely broad. So that's the most fertile ground. So I like to compare it to the warm tide pools where life is said to have evolved, sort of between the sea and the land, where the two meet. The littoral zone where the two meet is the most fertile ground, and so that between the territory of ordinary everyday perceptions and the mind in absorption, then that access concentration is that sort of the warm tide pools where it's the most fertile ground for cultivation. That it's the attention is very firmly grounded in the present moment experience, but there's no fixation on a single object, so that there's the range of liking and disliking, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking is coming and going and changing. So it's not just the quality of change, but the range of things that are changing, the spectrum of experience. So the more the mind is absorbed in jhana, then the spectrum of experience it gets narrower and narrower, and it's just fixed on one single object, really. And so that then that object is still changing, you know, but it doesn't have that kind of variety or the spectrum of qualities that is there at access concentration.
So would that be the place for what I would call a Dharma dialogue? It's like I would be dropping metta in that same space.
Yes, that I don't know about Dharma dialogue, but certainly that is the most supportive or helpful environment, because the attention is fully grounded in the present moment, you know, present reality, is attentive to the present experience, but it's not lost in any specific, or not absorbed into any particular thing. So essentially, with the development of vipassana, then there's a conscious letting go of the content of experience to look at the process of experiencing. So if you're deliberately cultivating one of the Brahma Viharas, like metta, then there's giving a specific direction to that, so that that's a little bit of a different focus than vipassana itself. You're still you're focusing the attention on a specific mental formation, like the quality of loving kindness, but it's still that the mind's say focusing or attention to the present and lack of distraction, but then is very supportive. But also, if you're picking up a particular quality like loving kindness, and you'll say, okay, that's an object, or that's a quality that is being say given particular strength, the mind isn't just withdrawing from all of the content of experience. It's picking up one particular aspect of the contents and strengthening it. So it's quite okay, you know. But for the development of vipassana, then the more that the attention is not favoring any particular perception, whether it's liking or disliking or comfort or discomfort or whatever, it's like the vipassana is really fulfilled by that sort of a radical non-entanglement, not buying into any of the content of experience, but looking at the process of experience itself. And so that's what really frees the heart, is that that disentanglement. So that the Buddha talked of the Brahma Viharas, like loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. They are liberations, but they are conditioned states. They're not transcendent states. They are so that they are. You're still, the mind is still sort of in a way investing in some aspect of the conditioned realm. Whereas vipassana, the sort of the core or the heart of vipassana is that letting go of any investment or particular focus on an aspect of the conditioned realm. Okay, the next section is called podi, another Thai expression, which po means enough and di means good, podi. So literally good enough or enough good. Podi was another common everyday word that Lumpur's disciples got to hear a great deal. Podi means just right, or just the right amount. It refers to the optimum amount, neither too much nor too little. If a robe fits well, neither too long nor too short, then it's podi. For some people, a sitting meditation period of 30 minutes might be podi. For others, podi might be an hour or more. Podi was the term that Lumpur used when he wanted to talk about the middle way more informally. He said that the ability to tune into the podi mode for any activity is at the very heart of Dhamma practice. He would often tell the story of Venerable Sona, who was taught by the Buddha to practice meditation in the same way that he had formerly played the lute, with strings neither too taut nor too loose. So Sona had been a musician before he was a bhikkhu, and he had been overly ardent and sort of tense or strict in his practice, and had done so much walking meditation that his feet had got torn up, and there was blood all over his walking meditation path. And so then he was invited to go and see the Buddha, and said the Buddha said, "It's well, like when you played the vina, played the lute, this stringed instrument. What was it like if your strings were too loose? And well, the sound was very flat. And if the strings were too tight, then the sounds were too sharp." So he said, "So just as you would adjust the strings of your vina to have everything in a harmonious relationship, all the strings, the notes of the strings harmoniously related together, neither too sharp nor too flat, then it's important to develop the practice in the same way." And that sutta is in the Book of the Sixes, the Anguttara Nikaya, sutta number 55. Lumpur taught his disciples to develop a sensitivity to what was podi in every area of their lives. At the mealtime, awareness of podi meant just taking enough food to fill the stomach, but not so much as to overeat and cause drowsiness or laziness. Podi in sleeping meant taking enough rest to refresh the body, but not so much as to be indulgent. Everything had to be not too fast, not too slow, not too tight, not too loose, quote unquote. He cautioned against the understanding that upholding Pordi as a standard implied a bland moderation in all things. Pordi was to be gauged by the extent to which an action was conducive to the solving of a problem or the attainment of a goal. At certain times and places, a practice might seem to be extreme in the short term, but with regard to overall progress, it might in fact be Pordi. In any endeavour, Pordi represented the optimum, the most efficient strategy. But how was a monk to know when his practice was Pordi? Lumpur would answer this question with a simile. Again, it's Lumpur speaking here. It is as if you want to row a boat straight across a swiftly flowing river. You don't aim your boat in a straight line. You aim slightly upstream, allowing for the strength of the current to carry you a little downstream, and so, consequently, straight across. In the same way, it's wisest to pitch your practice at a slightly more demanding level than you believe to be Pordi, and allow for the strength of defilement to carry you down to the correct level. I teach you to eat little, sleep little, talk little. Everything has to be little. But is that Pordi? Actually, it's not. It hasn't reached that even consistency, but I teach it to enable you to recognize Pordi, just rightness, to see what is appropriate for you. Rushing too much is not right. Know how to balance different interests until you find the right amount. If there's too little, then add to it. If there's too much, take some away. This is right practice, or Pordi. In the suttas, the Buddha teaches the middle way that avoids the two extremes of sensual indulgence and empty asceticism. Lumpur liked to expand on the meaning of these two extremes to include like and dislike, pleasure and pain. By doing so, he sought to make clear that the teaching was not so much about a general approach to spiritual development as a moment-by-moment stance towards mental states. And again, this is Lumpur speaking here. Just rightness means not being drawn into either of the two extremes. Kama sukalikanu yoga, being lost in pleasure and comfort and happiness, indulging in thoughts of being good, excellent, sublime. Attakilamatanu yoga, aversion, suffering, dislike, anger. These two extremes are not paths that a monastic should follow. The monastic sees those paths, but he doesn't follow them, doesn't attach to them. In order to attain peace, he lets go of them. He abandons them. The ability to maintain practice on this optimum Pordi level was dependent on the wisdom faculty and the perception of changefulness. Again, Lumpur is speaking. The practice becomes Pordi when you recognize the impermanence of every mental state that arises and tell your mind that it's Maineya. Patiently endure right there. Don't move onwards from that knowing. Don't retreat from it. Persist at that point, and before long, you will come to know the truth. Leaders of communities were also to constantly refer to the sense of Pordi, whether in implementing monastic regulations or determining a daily schedule. In this context, Pordi was to be acknowledged as a temporary balance that would need to be regularly recalibrated, rather than a standard that, once achieved, could be sustained long term. After an initial flurry of enthusiasm, there will be a slow but inexorable slipping of standards until an admonitory discourse from Lumpur would re-establish the standard. So to explain a few of Ajahn Jayasaro's words there, regularly recalibrated to rethink exactly what will be the right amount, or to be a change of schedule or an adjustment to things along the way. Inexorable means something that can't be stopped. So an inexorable slipping of standards means that you start off at this level, but just that the force of gravity, sort of slowly things get a little bit weaker and slacker and softer, and they wear down. So inexorable means that kind of unstoppable quality. An admonitory discourse, as admonition is to say to scold or to correct or to make a strong a strong point or to speak in a strong way to correct somebody. An admonitory discourse from Lungpo would re-establish the standard. Recognizing this pattern, Lungpo would start each new cycle on the strict side of Pordi as a way of retarding the process or holding back that inexorable decay, like steering up the river, as he was just describing. Once, when a monk complained that the standard that Lungpo had set was too strict and tight, Lungpo replied, "Tight is good. Before long, it will ease off by itself." So in Pali, there's a set of qualities, the seven attributes of someone who is a sapurisa, or a good person. So a few of those, one is matanyuta, knowing the right amount. So, and they kind of relate to Pordi. Knowing the right amount, matanyuta, and then kalanyuta, knowing the right time, so that the choosing the best moment to do something or to say something. So kalanyuta, knowing the right time to do something, matanyuta, knowing the right amount. Those are two of the seven qualities of a sapurisa. So this emphasis on Pordi is a lot of that. To live as a well-rounded person, a sapurisa. I think well-rounded person is a good rendition of sapurisa, a good person or a well-rounded person, or someone is a mature person. They know the right amount, they know the right time for doing things. And this quality of Pordi, of having a sense of what the right amount is a moment-by-moment attunement to the time, the place, the situation, what's needed, who you're with, what your own capacities are, and so on and so forth. And so it's very much a living quality. There's no strict formula that you can apply that guarantees you have a little sort of Pordi meter. Maybe there's someone's developing an app for an iPhone, a Pordi app. Is this the right amount? Okay. A little kind of dial that tells you what the Pordi meter is telling you. But they haven't developed that just yet. Maybe not too long before those kind of things. I always thought there should be a paramita meter. So you can sort of put a beam on Venerable Anejo. Okay. A lot of patience, yeah, wisdom, yeah. Could be developed. Just joking. So 7 o'clock has gone by once more, so let's call it a close for today then.